This is Breaking Down Security, and I am Brian Brake.
And I am Joe Gray. Welcome to Breaking Down the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast Holiday Special and Book Club Kickoff.
Well, that went well.
Yeah, why don't we do that?
No, that's cool. No, I tend to do things only in one take. So we got Joe Gray here this week from Advanced Persistent Security. I got that wrong, didn't I?
No, that's absolutely correct. Okay. It is Advanced Persistent Security.
Right on. And of course, we got Mr. Betcher here for my co-host and the TARDIS to my Doctor Who from Breaking Down Security.
Yeah, that's right. Looks like we have three different podcasts on right now.
That's right.
Right?
Tis true.
That's right. And actually, our guest for our two or three podcasts this week is Gary McGraw, Dr. Gary McGraw, I'm sorry. He does his own show called the Silver Bullet Podcast.
That's right. Silver Bullet Security Podcast.
Right on. Excellent.
For 10 years.
Am I the only one on this podcast besides Gary that actually listens to Silver Bullet? I mean, it's a great podcast. I've been listening to it for probably a year and a half. So,
I listen to it because I kind of have to.
I listen to this one because I have to.
We have about 30,000 listeners per episode. Yeah.
Goodness.
I've been listening for quite a while. I especially enjoyed the episode with Marty Hellman.
Yeah, that was a good one. Marty's a great guy. I did both Whit Diffie and Marty Hellman at different times, so we've covered Diffie Hellman.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'm still catching up. When I listen to a new show, I'm usually listening like from episode one on. So when I found like Risky Business and all the other ones, I've started to like episode one and I'm trying to catch up. So I think you still have your afro and everything, from when you first started. So, Yeah. So actually, the reason we're having you on this week, and it's kind of there's a whole amalgam of things we wanted to talk to Gary about. The Breaking Down Security podcast has started a book club, and the first book we started with was Gary's book, which is in the other room.
Security book?
Yes.
Which one?
The building security.
The book Software Security, Building Security.
That's correct. It's actually upstairs. I was reading it last night. So, we're doing that book. And if anybody wants to join our book club, you can join our Slack channel, which is in the show notes of our show. But we wanted to discuss with Gary some of the aspects of the book. I put out a show just last week talking about... we talk about how to add security to the SDLC, but, we never really discuss the exact ways of doing so. So I mentioned talking about abuse cases and, adding test cases for security and stuff. And, we wanted to talk a little bit about your book and the recent acquisition, if that's still something you can talk about in generic terms and what that will mean for, like, the BSIM report, which we just talked about as well on our show.
Cool. Yeah, happy to talk about all that stuff.
Excellent. All right. Well, Joe, I don't want to hog the show because it's not really my show. So if you have any questions you'd like to start out with, feel free to start.
Okay. So the Advanced Persistent Security podcast kind of goes around the avenue of people just starting out, ideas for those who aren't necessarily seasoned veterans. I try to make it in a way that all people of all skill levels and experience levels can kind of get something out of it. So, the first thing I would like to make a comment, and that's in reading your book, I like the mention of making your code more useful in nature, as opposed to just writing more code, code for the purpose of code. And a recurring theme that I mentioned quite frequently on my podcast is the Zen of Python. And I specifically mentioned one piece of it, and that is that simple is better than complex and complex is better than complicated.
Yep.
And I think, what you said in your book laid the groundwork for that specific statement. So, with that comment, thank you so much for putting that into words from a source that people can listen to that's not just an Easter egg in Python.
My pleasure. There are actually three things that are super important that I call the Trinity of Trouble. And the first time I wrote about those was in a book called Exploiting Software that I wrote with Greg Hoglund in 2008. And the three things are complexity, number one, like you said, Joe, extensibility, and then just being connected on the network. So being networked and extensibility are just as important as complexity, it turns out. And together, those three things make software security so interesting that I've been doing it for 21 years.
And so in your book, you have the three pillars that you mentioned. For people who don't have the book or are, you know, trying to get it for our book club, could you explain those and give us the 5-minute version of what each of those are?
Yeah, the pillars don't matter so much as the touch points. So maybe we should talk about those instead. Is that okay?
All right. Sounds good.
So here's the deal. There are many, many different kinds of software methodology that different software developers use and different organizations use. In fact, many organizations, though they claim to use one methodology, say Waterfall or Agile or Joe's Way or whatever, they end up using many, many methodologies. So the idea behind the touch points is to abstract away from a particular methodology and focus on the security stuff that you should do regardless of methodology. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the touch points are pretty straightforward. There are 7 of them, and the reason that I limited it to 7 is because that's what people can keep in their minds at any one time. And they're pretty straightforward. They follow basically the life cycle of software from the very beginning, from ideation when you're working on requirements, all the way from to when you ship software and you have to worry about software environment stuff. And that really is the heart of the book, if you think about it. I did use the pillars to organize the book in an even bigger sense, mm-hmm. but the pillars are, you know, less important than the touch points. And the touch points can be ordered too. So let me just tell you about maybe 2 of them, the 2 most important touch points. Number 1, if you have code, you should review that code. And if you have code that can be reviewed automatically by a program, for God's sakes, use a program to review your code. There are many kinds of code review that can be done automatically. It doesn't all have to be static. It can be dynamic analysis as well. And modern languages like Python and Ruby and JavaScript require a different approach, but they should still be reviewed. So that's the number 1 touch point. Review your darn code. Number 2 touch point is do some risk analysis at the architecture level. So take a look at your design and make sure that you're not designing things incorrectly, because there are 2 sorts of defects that lead to security issues. One is bugs, and that's what your static analysis or your automated code review will find. And the other is flaws at the design level. So those 2 touch points together out of the 7 are by far the most important. And one last little piece, and then I'll give you back to Mike. The 3rd touch point is penetration testing. So sure, you should do that, but should you start with that? Not really. Mm. Hey, back over to you.
Yep. Yeah, we've talked about that with our the Sans Top 20. It's like everything should be done before you do your pen testing. So if you're not doing those first 2, you're going to suffer on the 3rd one. You know, you have to build upon that.
That's right, and it's economically silly, because if you don't wait to find your bugs and your flaws until you've already got something ready to ship, it costs a lot more money to fix the stuff once you find it with a pen test. Mm-hmm. Now, you should do a pen test, let me get this straight, but you shouldn't start with a pen test. That shouldn't be the first thing that you do. It should be probably the 3rd or 4th thing you should do.
Yep,
exactly, and to chime in here, you know, I know you kind of have mixed opinions about bug bounty programs. So, you know, with both of those, realistically, unless you're mandated by regulatory compliance, and right now there's no regulatory compliance that mandates bug bounties, that's the only reason I can see for someone to be able to jump into a pen test quickly is if mandated by regulatory compliance. But maybe not. Yeah.
So usually the regulations are not that specific. There are some regulations like PCI that allow that as an option, but that's not a regulation, remember. That's just a compliance regime set up to avoid regulation.
Mm-hmm.
That
right.
The credit card guys. And it's really important to understand the difference between real compliance, regulatory compliance, and little schemes to avoid compliance like PCI. But that said, PCI can be... You can approach it multiple ways. Another way is to have touch points into your SDLC. So it doesn't just have to be start with pen testing, even though that is one way to do it.
Yep.
I do want to address bug bounties, though, Joe. I actually think bug bounties are totally fine. And I think that advanced organizations set up bug bounties and they benefit from those. However, you should never set up a bug bounty system before you've set up a software security initiative that's actually working. Because this, if you're paying other people to find bugs for you, but you're still producing bugs in your software development lifecycle, you know, while you're paying people to find your bugs, you're on this horrible hamster wheel of pain and you're producing bugs and paying other people to find them.
Sure.
So you got to figure out how to not produce them first and then turn your bug bounty program on. See what I mean?
Gary, on bug bounties, I sometimes see bug bounties as a way for immature software organizations to sort of pen test or handle these bugs as well. I mean, it's a level three.
But then they're going to produce more indefinitely, right? They're not getting any better. So they're going to continue to produce bugs and they're going to just pay hackers all the time to find the bugs they should have found themselves.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. But
it's expensive.
It's so easy to hire a company like BugCrowd or somebody to come in and do a bug bounty program in lieu of penetration testing, right?
Yeah.
Or,
and I don't think that's a good idea myself. For the same reason, I would not suggest they start with penetration testing. It's exactly the same rationale that we were talking about before.
Yep.
So try to find your bugs as early as you can find them, and try to teach your developers, if you possibly can, not to make new bugs so that you don't have to pay bug bounty stuff, or you do a pen test and your pen test doesn't find all sorts of stuff. It's always going to find something. But, you know, that's a way of approaching this from an economically reasonable point of view, in my view.
It's kind of like to channel my inner Michael Santarcangelo of how tall do you have to be to ride the ride?
Yeah.
Have you met the maturity level with regards to your security program in terms of your enterprise defenses, your security posture in terms of policies, procedures, technical guidelines, and what have you, your AppSec program, your incident response program? You know, once all those things are in place or starting to come into place is when I would say, you know what, it might be a good time to start your bug bounty program with low dollar amount rewards. You don't want to start with a $200,000 reward in your first run unless you're someone like, say, Apple, who has a very mature application security program.
Well, I think you may be exaggerating the maturity of their application security program, but they do have one.
Yeah, isn't the $200,000 bounty more a marketing thing, you know, showing that, oh, yeah, we, you know, putting our money where our mouth is kind of bit?
I don't think that's the way to look at it. So bug bounties are a very efficient way of squeezing your penetration testing backlog down to nothing fast.
Hmm.
But if you're still producing bugs, that's the problem.
True.
So if you have a way of eradicating bugs and you're not producing more, then using a bug bounty to sort of get rid of that technical debt is a good idea from an economic
perspective.
And I've always said that, you know, Katie and I talked about this years ago before she even joined HackerOne. And now that she's gone on to do other stuff, you know, there's less noise in the less hype in the bug bounty space. But when we look at real bug bounty programs that real companies have, we have, you know, 100 companies in the BSIM, and I think it's 7 of them have bug bounty programs right now. And they're important. The ones they have pay out a fair amount of money. They're real bug bounty programs, but they're only 7 out of 100.
And with that being said, you know, Hack the Army is about to start. I am hoping to participate on the opposing end of Hack the Army. During Hack the Pentagon, I was a defender working on a contract. And, you know, based on what I saw, without divulging specific information, it basically pointed out that the Department of Defense is lacking in their application security program.
Absolutely right, Joe. They're way behind. I think the whole federal government is significantly behind. U.S. federal government is significantly behind in software security. And that's kind of a bummer. because we look to, you know, places like Fort Meade to be really good at computer security, but they are not very good at software security, frankly.
Exactly. Is that because a GS rating is, you know, they're woefully underpaid, so you get what you pay for?
I don't think it's just employment opportunity, although that's probably part of it. I think that the private sector long ago came to realize that bits are money and that they've got to protect those bits. And so the financial services organizations help to spearhead software security at the same time that big software companies like Microsoft realized they had to get their shit together. Mm-hmm. And that was about, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Over the last 15 years, we've seen massive progress in software security. Meanwhile, the government's like way back, at least 5 or 6 years behind right now. And I think that they acknowledge that. When I go talk to, say, Doug Maughan at DHS, he'll agree that that's the case. And I guess one of the things that we should point out is that, you know, we don't really count on the government innovating anything. And I'm not sure why we should start with software security, because it's just like everything else. The government does not innovate. You know, corporations innovate, individuals innovate, scientists innovate. The government provides a fair amount of scientific research money for real academic researchers to innovate. And that's an important aspect of making progress in a scientific field. But that doesn't really talk about putting software security to work every day out there in the world. My view from the BSIM shows that financial services organizations and big independent software vendors are kind of neck and neck in software security goodness these days. And they're leading the world.
Gary, you said the author of the BSIM, which I assume it was you. I'll just assume it was you at this point.
Yeah, there are three.
Well, you're the only one here, right?
Yep.
So you said that.
Down the hall, I could go get them.
Yeah. Well, hey, if you want. You said software security people are often impossible to find. Really? Impossible? Come on.
Well, it's so a lot of people would like to pretend that anybody who knows anything about security can be a good software security person. And I'm sorry that I have to disagree with that, but I totally disagree with that. People that are very good at security who don't know anything about software and how it's built and how makefiles work and how you know, what a wall of code looks like and what millions of lines of code are actually like to manage, have no business doing software security. And my view, as I stated in the book, has always been you should start with software people and teach them about security, because it's easier to teach a software guy about security than it is to teach a security guy about software. And I think we've made some progress over the last, you know, decade since I wrote that book in 2006, by the way. Although I think it's still got a lot of good stuff in it, it is a decade old. And it still gets used in classrooms. And I think we still have a shortage of software security people. But I'll tell you this, when I wrote that book, Cigital had about 80 people. And now we have 500. And those are 500 people doing software security full time. And when we join with Synopsys, which we're going to, you know, because we just got acquired by those guys, we're going to have 1,000 people doing software security full time. That's the biggest software security shop on the planet.
That's one of the questions I wanted to ask. You wrote the book in 2006, and it's almost, 12 years old? 12 years old?
Your math is not very good.
I know. I don't math very well. It's the day after a major holiday. So would there have been any sections of that you think no longer apply, or do you think there's any sections that, in the second edition, what would you change?
I hate chapter 2, so rip that out and throw it away. Even though there's a lot of good thinking in there, it's a chapter. And I think that, you know, I would focus more on the meat of the touch points and just get rid of all that risk management hoo-ha. It's important to take a risk-based approach, but the idea that I wrote about in chapter 2, you can just scrap that.
Were you drinking heavily when you wrote that one or something?
No, it was just 10 years ago, you know?
Not to say.
And I'll tell you, if you want to sort of catch up with the field of software security, I think the best thing to do is to pair the book with the BSIM. And the BSIM is, you know, available for free. You can download it under the Creative Commons and use it however you see fit.
Mm-hmm.
And it is just absolutely chock full of great information about what real companies do every day to do software security. In fact, BSIM 7 describes the work of 1,111 full-time software security people that have a little army that's in each of their organizations of another 3,000 people in the satellite. So that's like 4,000 people that the BSIM describes, what these 4,000 professionals do every day. So if you want to sort of catch up to the now, definitely pair the book with the BSIM for sure.
So Gary, on the BSIM, I mean, when it started, there were, what, nine or 10 companies that were, quote, nine companies that were very advanced in security. And, you know, you say that you should use the BSIM as a measuring stick against your own organization.
Yeah.
Now, in the latest version, you have 95 companies.
Yep.
And you admit that some of them don't really have mature security programs. So doesn't that having those companies in the BSIM kind of muddy the waters a little bit, and it's not that good of a measuring stick anymore as it once was when you had very advanced?
That's a really good question. And the answer is no, for the same reason that when you have a ruler, it can measure things that are 1.5 inches tall, and it can measure things that are 12 inches tall, but it's the same ruler.
Okay.
I mean, I hate to be trite, but that's the truth of the matter. And if we had not started out with companies that were mature enough, or we didn't have them in the union of all the companies in the BSIM, then we wouldn't know how tall was.
Hmm.
But we do know how tall is because we've been doing it, you know, for, I guess, 8 years. And I still think it's a fantastic measuring stick. And it's like a thermometer. You know, back in the days of early thermometers, some dude just put some lines on a tube of mercury and he was like, all right, so, you know, water freezes at 32 lines. I'm not sure why. And, you know, it boils at 212. I'm not sure why, but it's 32 to 212. We still use that, right? And that's perfectly fine because we use it consistently each time. So you got to sort of take the data away from the measurement tool. And the BSIM is a measurement tool. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Cool.
Perfect.
So, and to kind of play with your thermometer or reference, you know, just to kind of draw a quick parallel, you know, a lot of people measure things differently. To go with a thermometer, you know, you had that guy that came along and said water froze at 32 notches and boiled at 12.
That's right.
Exactly. And then you had someone else come along and it was like, well, by my measure, water freezes at zero and boils at 100.
Yeah.
So that's just another way to convey to the audience that, you know, while you may have one standard of measurement, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's always absolute. There's always that extra way to skin a cat, so to speak.
That's right, Joe. That's exactly right. All that I ask is that anybody who would like to come up with a measurement tool, base it on real data and not just on a couple of data points. And so, you know, back in 2006, when I wrote that book, the idea of integrating best practices into all of your different SDLCs was pretty novel. Now it's just like, duh. And so in order to get past the, you know, early days, the philosophy days and the early adopter days into a more engineering-based approach to this field, we needed measurement. And that's where the BSIM came from.
So
let me tell you the story about how that started. It's kind of fun.
So your ruler does change, though, from time to time. You are taking old data out. So
that's right.
The stick does get higher. So this year...
Well, no. The stick doesn't actually move too much. The stick has remained pretty much the same, although there are some minor changes. That's true. But the data set doesn't really change the stick that much. What it does is it tells you how popular various activities are and what firms that have done software security for a long time that are doing well seem to do.
And you have to dig into that because you do separate a lot of those things. Here's what mature companies look like, and here's what the less mature companies mm-hmm. look like. So that's the right. distinguishing factor there.
That's right. And you know what's interesting, or maybe it's not interesting. Maybe it's pedantic and not surprising. The high maturity companies are rare. So the things that they do that are kind of, you know, rocket science level, they're rare. We don't see them very often. Yeah. And easy stuff is easy, so everybody does it. So that's kind of the way we did the levels, and we have a statistical model that helps us to make sure that activities end up in the right level. But we let the data do the talking. However, the data hasn't, like, made us change from measuring things, you know, height of things to width of things. It's not like we changed our whole measurement regime as this thing has evolved. It's pretty much stayed consistent, which is really cool. And because of that, you know, I guess I'm a little hesitant to say, but it's really become kind of a de facto standard for software security among big firms that are doing software security in a serious way.
So how many companies have you guys turned down to be a part of the BSIM?
A bunch. So people come to us and they're like, we want a BSIM measurement. And we say, great. Do you have a software security group? Do you have a product security group? Do you have an application security group? And they look at us like, huh? And we go, we can't measure you because you're not tall enough. You're not even going to be on our scale. So go build yourself a product security approach, and then we'll tell you whether it's any good. Or, you know, I work for Cigital, so we help people build those. We can build an SSG for a company that needs one from scratch, but we wouldn't start with a BSIM because there's nothing to measure there. On the other hand, if you have a new software security group, and it does exist, there's some people whose responsibility is to get software security done, and they want to sort of level set and know where they're starting from, then we can do a BSIM measurement. It'll be really small. And then they can figure out, you know, whether they've made progress after a year or two. So there are many firms that have been using the BSIM and remeasuring themselves every 18 months or so. About 30 firms have done that. There's one firm that's measured itself 5 times in the history of the BSIM project and the BSIM project. And they let them... They use that as the way to kind of strategically make sure they're working on the right stuff.
Do you ever see the BSIM as, where do you see it going from here? I mean, do you ever see companies like, we want to be on the BSIM because we want to show how mature we are? Or do they ever try to use that as like a marketing thing? Oh, look, we're, you know, 85% of, you know, what they're mentioning in the report applies to us. Do you ever see that kind of marketing?
That's a great question, and the answer is that we're very careful about that kind of marketing. We did give SAP permission to do that because we were sure that if they did that, they wouldn't out anybody else's data. And for us, the most important thing is that we're data-driven, that we're scientific, and that whatever we do, we don't expose individual firms' data. If they want to expose themselves, that's fine. But if the exposure of any particular firm even sheds a little bit of light on the other measurements of the other firms, that's bad.
Yeah.
And so even though we did give SAP permission to do that, they never did do anything with it. They didn't do any marketing.
Yeah.
Now what we do see is a little more subtle. There are a bunch of firms who have hundreds of suppliers, and their suppliers have different approaches to software security. Some are good and some are bad. And there are firms that use BSIM scores to justify that they're a good supplier to various firms, especially to large major banks. So, you know, when you can go as, say, Microsoft or EMC, or I guess that's Dell now, or, you know, a big firm, and you can say, hey, we really have our act together. You know, we participate in the BSIM. And a bank like Bank of America says, oh, that's cool, we do too. Then they're speaking the same language. And that's very helpful for everybody. So one of the things that you don't really see in the public persona of the BSIM is that it is a very strong community. Those firms, we get together, we have a conference. It's a closed conference. It's Chatham House rules. And the content in that conference is just mind-bogglingly great stuff. Because we have people that are in charge of 100 folks doing software security with a $10 million a year budget. In a big organization, they give a talk about this works and this doesn't work and these people are full of crap and this tool is good. And, you know, it's the real stuff. And that's been kind of the most surprising and, I don't know, the best part of the BSIM from my perspective.
Very cool. Joe, do you have any questions?
So, you know, Gary, we kind of had a quick exchange on Twitter and me jokingly saying, why is the NIST doing this? Because your book already exists.
That was great, Joe. You really made me laugh.
Hey, you know, any way to make life easy on the government. You know,
that was awesome.
We've got enough stuff going on. So with that being said, in response to NIST Special Publication 500-320, mm-hmm. it's basically a workshop for software security and summary. What advice could you provide to them that would be of value to kind of help them become that catalyst, that paradigm shift, to actually start to get software security right?
I think they need to read the BSIM, frankly. And the way to get software security right is to go out and do it. And I've been doing it for 20 years, and the BSIM's been around for almost 8 of those 20. And I think there's a big difference between talking about regulatory hoo-ha and saying you could do this, you could do that, and having theory versus going out and putting it into practice in a bank that's under massive attack all the time.
Do you find it ironic that the NIST is creating standards that they require people to follow to be customers with the government, and yet, by your own admission, and you mentioned that software security in the government is poor, and they don't seem to follow their own model?
Yeah, I do find it ironic. What I believe is that there will probably be an emergence of standards and maybe things kind of like PCI that help people in the commercial market measure and understand software security that become de facto standards, and that's what should become NIST standards. NIST is not going to lead here. It's too late for them to lead. You know, we've been leading for 20 years, so they can just get in the parade if they want. And I think it's a little naive to think that they can somehow get on top of all the progress that we've been making in this field. Now, I absolutely welcome them telling people to do sane things. And if what they're telling people to do turns out to be sane and it aligns with reality and it aligns with the data in the BSIM, then maybe that'll be good for everybody. You know, but if they tell people to do stuff that's just nuts, that involves filling out a lot of forms and, you know, getting things done in triplicate and having it stamped by somebody from the state of Tennessee, that's silly.
Hey, I resemble that.
I say that as a guy from Tennessee.
Okay. You're from Tennessee as well?
Originally, yeah. I grew up in Kingsport.
Okay. I have a few clients in Greenville and Johnson City now. I'm currently
Johnson City. That's I lived halfway between Kingsport and Johnson City when I was a kid.
Exactly. I'm originally from the Knoxville area, and I'm about to move back. I've accepted a position in Knoxville, but I'm fulfilling my teaching obligations. So,
congratulations, Joe. That's great. Back to Tennessee.
Exactly. Thank you. So, it's good and refreshing to hear someone say something about someone from Tennessee on a podcast and it not being snark.
You know that Dan Gere is also from Tennessee. So there's a few security people, and Avi Rubin is also from Tennessee. So we're all
a couple of the guys on PVCSEC, Edgar Rojas is from Tennessee, and I believe Paul Jorgensen lived in Tennessee for a while as well.
Cool. So, it doesn't count if you live there. You had to be born there.
Okay. Well, then
transplants don't count.
That's right.
We're doing it right.
I've been living in Virginia for 21 years, but I still feel like a Tennessean sometimes.
Hey, I lived in Virginia for about 4 years, so I definitely understand that angle as well. But, you know, to kind of get back to the whole NIST thing, so what if they just do the OWASP top 10? And I understand this is a fully loaded question. I listened to your podcast enough to know what the outcome of this statement is going to
Woo-hoo!
Be.
They'll find the 10 random things, and software security is not about eradicating 10 random things. So,
okay. You know. I had to put that out there.
I just did a podcast with Jim Manico. Did you listen to that one?
That's exactly where I got that from.
Yeah, that was 3 ago. And Jim is a very active OWASP guy. He's a leader and, you know, he's a reasonable thinker in software security. It was fun to have Jim on. He, of all people, said, oh my God, you should read the top 10 and then you should throw it away and never use it again.
Exactly.
And that leads exactly into my next statement, which honestly, I had never heard of this until I did my podcast with Frank Rieta, and he mentioned the ASVS.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think there's a little bit more value from OWASP in the ASVS than in the top 10.
Yep.
And, you know, perhaps if you can find a way to get the ASVS in concert with BSIM, then, you know,
well,
of course.
Well, the ASVS is about a set of vulnerabilities and things to look for. And you can build some of that stuff into tools, which will automatically, you know, look for those things. And you can design your languages, future languages, so that they don't even have the possibility of some of those vulnerabilities in them. But the BSIM is not about lists of bugs at all. Yeah. It's about using tools. It's about gathering knowledge. And so my view is if I haven't really thought about this, but if you look in the BSIM, there will be a activity or two that you would get credit for if you use the ASVS the way it's intended to be used. In fact, you know, if you're, you know, say, using one static analysis tool versus the other, the BSIM doesn't give a damn, doesn't care. It's just like, use a static analysis tool. You know, we have those now and you should use them. So that's where the BSIM is descriptive of what's going on in the world and not really prescriptive. You should do it this way. It says, these are the things everybody's doing. These are the things you should consider doing. And here's how to measure yourself. That's the philosophy behind the BSIM.
So I have a question regarding an SDLC. Like most things, we tend to strap security on afterwards. So we had the SDLC, and now we have the secure SDLC. We had RSH, and now we have SSH, you know, those kinds of things. Are there any new type of software life cycles or development, you know, life cycles that don't have security bolted on?
Well, you know, these DevSecOp people or OpSecDev or OpiDevySecy, whatever it is, I can't remember the order, they would like to claim that they've licked it from that perspective. My worry is that when we think about agile methodologies and DevOps, we can use automation and we can speed up the evaluation cycle, and we should. Mm-hmm. But tools alone will not solve this problem. And, you know, language choice matters more than you might imagine. And architecture matters a hell of a lot. And if you look at DevOps, you just don't even see that. It's like, where did the architecture get designed?
Yeah.
You know, and so I think that there's going to be a backlash against that stuff, which is back to design. And I think that our field has by and large ignored design to our peril and to our folly. We tried to counter some of that with some work that I did with the IEEE. We built this thing called the IEEE Center for Secure Design, and we built a list of the top 10 flaws, not top 10, but 10 flaws that really matter, so that people could begin to understand the difference between a bug, like a SQL injection bug, and a flaw, like a I forgot to authenticate the user flaw. Mm-hmm. And what those differences are and how you deal with those. And I think that, you know, hopefully some of the backlash for DevOps or whatever, DecSev, Seki, DepiOpsy, that'll help bring to bear some of these ideas that about software architecture and design that we've forgotten about that we got to get back to. I sound like an old guy when I say that, but I'm going to stick to my guns on that one.
Yeah, well, you know, I see a lot of that with the agile development. It's like, you know, some of the security not involved. You know, they mention, oh yeah, we'll document everything after everything's been done, and then, you know, they never go back to the documentation stuff, which I think is a fairly decent sized design flaw, because if you don't know how the thing is built in the first place, and all your knowledge is up in somebody's head and not in either a wiki page or, you know, in proper, you know, documented code. You really can open yourself up to all kinds of fundamental disasters in the long run.
That's exactly right. I mean, I can tell you a story. This is from like 15 years ago. We had somebody who brought us a design, and they were like, here's our design. Can you do a design analysis? And we were like, sure, that's what we do. So we did an analysis of their design, and we went back to them, and we said, this won't work. So, you know, you're shipping product, so this won't work. So what did you do? And the engineering people said, oh, yeah, yeah, we found out that wouldn't work, so we did it this way. And we're just like, ah, we did an analysis of a design that isn't even real. Like, what are you doing?
That's their money, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Well, I mean, at least we told them that the design they had on paper wouldn't work.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
It's always good to tell people their baby is ugly.
Oh, man. That, you know, that's a big problem with security, isn't it? But it's better if you can teach developers how to do it right. And the sooner you can do that in the life cycle, and the sooner you can do that in school, and the sooner you can not have people learn bad habits, the better off we'll all be.
Okay. Well, that's
so, Gary, in the BSIM, there's an average of developer to software security person ratio of 60 to 1. From a business perspective, is that a good number?
I don't know. That's a really good question, Brian. It is the number. I mean, that's the thing about the BSIM. It doesn't make a value judgment about that. It just says, here's 100 firms. They have a 60 to 1 ratio. That's their ratio. And so if you have your own firm and you're like, gosh, you know, my ratio is 400 to 1. That seems a little different than those other 100 firms. You can take that as some ammunition and you can go, guys, you know, everybody else has a lot more people on this than we do. Maybe we should rethink our approach. Yeah. Or if you have one security guy for every developer, you're probably overdoing it. You know, and so you can look at that number 60 and you can go, well, we're like a whole order of magnitude off. That's probably a little bit of a problem. So is 60 the right number? Beats the hell out of me. That's just the number.
Yeah. And what's good is you don't break that down by industry. So it's not like you don't have to go, well, what is my competitor doing? Am I doing good enough? And, you know, how many men in the yellow hat versus Georges do you have, you know, running the show?
I like it. Is Curious George the security guy or is it the man in the yellow hat?
I would like to believe that we're the man in the yellow hat. We bring a little bit of logic and reason to, you know.
He was a bad guy, man. He, like, caught George in a cage and stuff.
I always thought of George as the security guy and the man in the yellow hat as being the compliance guy.
Now we're getting to some super critical software security stuff.
Ouch. So you talked about developer training. So now that the horse is out of the stall and running amok, and you know, how do you rein the developers back in and get them decent training? I mean,
I think one of the things that we can do that we've been working hard on at a subsidiary of Sigital called Codascope, which also got bought by Synopsys, is going to happen in the same transaction, is think about little pieces of learning that can be integrated into your everyday work. So you're typing along in your IDE, or you're doing an assembly in JavaScript, and the engine goes, whoa, dude, that's not the way to do it. Do it like this. Hmm. And so you're learning in real time. And my belief, I think Jim expressed this in that podcast, you know, Silver Bullet, a couple episodes ago. He said, you know, ILT is really important, but it's hard to scale instructor-led training. So you need to enhance that with tools that tell you, that remind you what you might have learned in ILT session. So you're typing along and the IDE goes, no, don't you remember that training or whatever. And I think that we're going to move in that direction. It may take a few years for that to, you know, really catch on, but I think we're going that way. And I think that's great, actually. That's a good aspect of software security. A bad aspect is all sorts of stuff we learned about programming languages, we're busy unlearning as we adopt really stupid programming languages like JavaScript.
So that's like an IDE that they can use to, you know, help them, you know, along?
It can be in an IDE, or it can be something that happens over the cloud as your assembly gets put together. There are multiple paradigms of this, and they have to do with the way different programming languages do things. So a dynamic language like JavaScript has a completely different approach than a compiled language like Java or like C++. And there are solutions to both of those sets of languages that are being developed.
Okay. Do you think we could find and suss out a lot of security bugs by just having proper compiler flags? Or forcing proper compiler flags?
I think proper language design would obviate many errors. I mean, if you look at C, for example, you might ask Brian Kernighan, which I once asked him, why is it that you guys put those really stupid string handling functions in C that lead to buffer overflows? Mm-hmm. And, you know, actually, I didn't ask him, but I was in a workshop with 30 people and somebody asked Brian that. And Brian said, well, you know what? That was Dennis's code.
I didn't do it. It was someone else.
No, he blamed Dennis Ritchie. So when I saw Dennis, I was like, dude, Brian said you wrote those stupid string handling functions. And you know what? Those guys, they designed that language to be super efficient. It's like assembly language on steroids. It's supposed to be coding to the metal. And there are ways to use C. There are good reasons to use C at certain times. And there are other reasons where you should be permanently banned as a particular type of human from using C. And we got to keep that straight. So I think that, you know, not only should compiler flags find problems, but hell, if the compiler's finding it, why is it in there in the first place?
Because you have to put it hard code in the warning bypass, right? String yeah. copy underscore S
yeah.
needs to be used. Well, that takes a lot of time. So
I
got to
tell you, I mean, in all seriousness, if you're doing a code review, if you do grep bug, you'll often find a comment that says, there's a bug here and I can't find it. And you're just like, let's start the review here.
Yeah. Mr. You know, Venture, so, why do you know about those flags? Is that something that's come up in your code recently?
But, well, when the warning comes up, I hate that because it's more work. But
yeah.
obviously, I hash through it and make amends with my compiler.
But let me tell you, this can go awry. So at an unnamed company that starts with Q and ends with Qualcomm, there was a directive that came down from on high that said your code must go through lint with no warnings. Like you have to run it through lint and the wall, but, you know, lint first. And so some brilliant engineer figured out that you could crash lint by making it try to parse this one little thing. So they put it in an include file. And that was attached to the front of every damn file in the whole place because it would just crash lint. So lint wouldn't give any warnings because it was crashed. Nice. And that piece of code ended up everywhere. We're like, never mind about that lint thing. That was wrong. Stop putting that include thing. And to this day, I bet there are pieces of code over there that still have that in it.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Reality.
So to chime in with the education perspective, you know, I teach at a couple of universities or one 2-year and one 4-year school. And, you know, I've kind of got a point of contention right now because I'm seeing more and more in the American landscape that people in authoritative positions, such as law enforcement, lawyers, and judges, they don't have that basic understanding of information technology, much less information security, as it applies to things that they're ruling on. But yet we still have a state requirement of introduction to computing. If you could make a change, would you, you know, how would you gear that? Would you do like a security and privacy course and then a follow-on application security course for programmers?
I don't know. That's a tough question, Joe. I mean, you have to decide what you're not going to teach if you do teach that. So the real question is, what are we teaching people about everything about life right now? I think that where we are currently, we have this generation of like my parents that are, you know, in their 70s who don't really understand technology very well. And of course, there's some super phenomenal technologists that I know that are friends of mine that are 70. But generally speaking, that generation doesn't know shit. And we just put them in charge again. I mean, I don't care about your politics, whether, you know, who you voted for president. Both of those people were over 70. Come on. You know? So,
I
think what one thing that we might do is just wait around a while for those people to just kick the bucket, and then we'll be in better shape with people that grew up understanding technology, building the rules and figuring out what the curricula should be. Is that a cheating way to answer your question?
No, honestly, I think it's a fair answer because, you know, I said this in front of some full-time staffers with doctorates. You know, I'm in a program, but I'm not quite there yet. Uh-huh. And you would have thought I dropped either the F-bomb or the N-bomb the way they looked at me when I said this introduction to computing class was probably great 10 years ago, but now we're dealing with students that grew up playing video games, students that grew up with affordable home computers. The only thing of value in the course really is Microsoft Office. So why can we not retool the rest of the class to encompass something with online privacy, online security? You know, how are you going – How is it going to be? How's that dynamic working with your security? I mean, you know, I'm a huge fan of OSINT right now. It's my flavor of the week. I think it's been the flavor of the month for a while now. But, you know, what can I glean from you off your social media? Just because it's not because you willingly put it out there. It's just that you're ignorant that you can say it without putting it out there.
Right. So I think those are all good points. And I do think that the next generation, and even my kids, like I've got a kid who's 21, right? He's in his last year in college. He's been using computers his whole dang life. And, you know, I was one of the rare people in my generation who had an Apple II Plus when I was 16 years old. It came out in 1981, and my parents got one for us because they drove to San Francisco to the only Apple store and bought one from Steve, like directly. And there are people like me, there are a few of my peers that grew up with computers, and, you know, we programmed, either it was an Apple or it was a Trash 80 or a Sinclair box or whatever, but we actually used that stuff when we were little kids. So I didn't have to go to school to learn to code. Hell, I'd been coding for years. I taught the guy who taught the high school class how pointers worked in Pascal. And I think that there's a set of us that are in my generation, and the good news is that in the next generation there are even more people. So maybe we just have to keep our fingers crossed and hope the old people don't screw everything up by the time we get our power back.
That's cool. I cannot agree more. And, you know, something I'm not seeing in the curricula now, you know, I teach at a four-year school that offers security as a concentration. They have, I think, three security classes, really. Mm-hmm. And it's like internet, information, and I believe operating system. Mm-hmm. I've levied for an application security, a web app, or even a cloud security class and been shot down.
Yeah. I can help you with that. Let's talk offline about how to get that fixed. But there, awesome. there are some organizations and some universities that are doing a really good job teaching software security. And they're doing it in novel and interesting ways. One thing that you can do is listen to a podcast I did a long time ago with Matt Bishop, who's been teaching computer security stuff for almost 20 years. He's a professor at UC Davis, and he has some really novel and very good ideas about how to teach people to code that securely by teaching them to code in the first place. And I think we'll come around to that. We're in the early days of, you know, we're building a lot of bespoke stuff. People are, they might copy a chunk of code. We got an open source promulgation problem and a code copying problem. And I think some of that stuff will go away as we get better. And my hope is that what happened to hardware over the last 30 years to move it from a pretty wild west, you know, well, we put some juice in there and the thing just fritzed out. We're like, ah, shit, change that around. And then we did another one and we fritzed that one out all the way to today, which is, you know, using compilers to compile VLSI and have prefabricated components and build up incredibly complex chips much more efficiently and effectively and hopefully securely. That sort of discipline that happened in hardware is going to happen in software. So get ready for that. Here it comes.
And, you know, to kind of cap this specific rabbit hole, if you will, that I've kind of driven us down, cap it off at the end. For anyone getting into security or already in software development, what advice do you provide to them to get into the application security arena in terms of resources and learning opportunities?
I think that, you know, reading my books is a good thing. There's some books that Microsoft wrote that are quite good. The BSIM is a great place to start, and that's free. OWASP has a bunch of good stuff, but they have a bunch of junk too, so you got to be able to separate the junk from the good stuff. Find a mentor. There are enough professionals doing software security today that we don't have to learn the basics. I mean, you still have to learn the basics, but we don't have to invent the basics. The basics are pretty well understood. And so I would say, you know, just like any other technical career, find somebody who you respect, who is well-known in that field, and ask them to help you. Ask them to mentor you and really go at it that way. But read what's available first. Don't just go try to find a mentor without having read anything, because that just shows that you don't know what the hell you're talking about. So yep. Hopefully that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense, because when students come to me asking for advice and mentorship, the first thing I tell them is, hey, you need to read these books, because these are some good books in the general scope of security or in the specific discipline you're looking at. Then I would, you know, get a few virtual machines and start to tinker with some things. And then at that point, then start asking questions of the professionals, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the things that I'm sure that you've run across as a professor, when you're teaching people, you'll find out they're different people. They think completely differently. And some people think by talking. And so while they're talking at you, they're actually thinking. And it drives me crazy, but there are people that's the way they think.
Unfortunately, I think I fall under that category.
You like stick them in a closet. You're like, come back when you're done talking to the wall, and then we'll go for it. Right.
I'm one of the few people I know that actually don't get offended when someone actually hangs up on me in the middle of a phone call, just because I just can't get to the point of shutting up.
Oh, that's hilarious. Well, then you make a good podcast host.
So, Gary, help me out. I see things as getting worse. You say things is going to get better. I mean, when I was a kid, when we bought a washing machine, that sucker worked. Maybe you had to replace a belt every now and again. But you could hire a repairman. They'd come over, fix it for, you know, $20 or whatever, and you wouldn't have to buy a new one. With this whole Internet of Things hitting us, companies are building something and selling it, making some money, and then moving on to the next thing, and they don't give a crap what happens to that older thing.
Right.
Right. So you say things are going to get better. I mean, I know you're coming from that build security in type mentality, but the companies, and there's a ton of them, yeah, are not going to subscribe to that because there's no money in it.
Well, I hope that you're wrong. And I think there's some evidence that the people that are building some of the Internet of Things stuff understand that consumers expect more than they used to think they expected last year. And I think that the way to look for progress is to look at the way banks are secured and where the banking systems that we rely on to run international finance, you know, to the tune of whatever, $400 quadrillion worth of transactions on Wall Street every year, we're doing a pretty reasonably good job. Now, is it perfect? No, but we know what to do when we're building systems like that. That goodness will trickle on down to consumer devices one day, and market forces will drive the hucksters that are building crap out of business. And you have to hope that that's the case. Either that, or people just don't really care about, you know, security as much as we thought. But really, if you want to think about it like this. There used to be days when whole cities burned down. Chicago burned down. San Francisco burned down. You could just build a building however the fuck you want, and you're just like, I got a building, and you know, you just it gets on fire, and then it catches on the neighbors, and the whole thing burns down. And eventually people said, this whole burning down of cities is gonna have to stop. And we're gonna have to have some rules about building buildings, and we're gonna have to have fire codes, and we're gonna have to regulate the way that you build buildings, and you're gonna have to have sprinklers and all this stuff. And you know what, now cities don't burn down anymore, unless we bomb them, you know, like Dresden. Cities just don't burn down. So that kind of the invisible hand of the market may take a while, but I do believe that it moves us along in the right direction, and that all hope is not lost, you know, that we actually have made great progress in computer security in the last 20 years. And I think that as a practitioner, we really started doing computer security in 1996, you know, 95. I've seen the progress. I'm pretty proud of the progress that we made, that we've been making. And I think we're making more. And now we have a whole field called software security. You know what? When I started working on this stuff, there were zero books on software security. So I wrote one in 1999. And we've made huge amount of progress since then. So I remain optimistic, and I know that that's a minority position in security. I'm supposed to be an old curmudgeon by now. But I do think that we can make progress by doing the right thing in some disciplines, in some domains, and having the right thing spread correctly as a good idea through other disciplines and other approaches, even into IoT.
So it's going to have to happen in one of two ways, either consumer-driven or government-driven.
Yeah.
So which way is it going to be?
Consumers. I'm a capitalist.
Yeah. Well, you know, it could be disaster-driven as well. I mean, we didn't see the adoption of EMV until massive card breaches occurred. You know, with the recent Mirai botnet, which can apparently you can buy 400,000 refrigerators and toasters to help DOS somebody off the map. Do you think it's going to take more Mirai-like botnets and attacks where people can't access things before we'll start seeing real change in that industry?
That's a really good question. I'm not so sure what the answer to that is in particular, but I do think that we don't have to have disasters. But frankly, disasters can be really helpful. Like, you know, I just invoked two disasters, the Chicago fire and the San Francisco fire of 1906. Those were big disasters, and they got people to go, huh, maybe we're not doing this right.
Yeah.
And when a DNS provider goes down, you know what? Who cares? I'm not sure why that was headline news. Maybe it was a slow news day. You know, so big deal. It got fixed, you know, and it was only DNS. And if you know anything about the internet works, you just sort of go, come on. Mm-hmm. You know, why do you have one DNS server? Hello. Why don't you have three? So I think that, you know, as we learn more, maybe we'll do a better job and maybe we won't require those disasters. But we're making mountains out of molehills, and we don't get to do that too often. So if we're like, Mirai was almost the end of the world, you know, it was like TVs and VCRs or whatever they call them now, TiVos that were all, you know, DVRs sending packets and clogging up the interwebs. Sure, we got to fix that, but it was not the end of the world, guys.
Yeah.
It wasn't like San Francisco burned down. So we got to stop pretending like that it is the end of the world. Now, we should say there's some chance we could cause the end of the world with our screwed up computers. But we're going to try to avoid that, and we're going to do some reasonable engineering. And, you know, just to harken back to an earlier point, we know how to build nuclear power plants in some countries that don't melt down, you know. And so maybe we should use the discipline that we use to have things fly through the air and generate our power and control big giant chemical processes. Maybe we should take some of that discipline and apply it to things that maybe don't need that much discipline, but they need some, like, say, thermostats or door locks.
Awesome.
And to kind of, you know, finish up with my thoughts on the Mirai botnet, I think, you know, it was a slow news day, but I think a lot of it was because of the websites that were impacted by it, you know, Twitter and Amazon.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wrote an entire blog post about it. Was actually called The Security of Porn. And what I did is I actually I ran a dig on four different domains, NSA, Facebook, Twitter, and Pornhub. Uh-huh. And I compared it. I was like, look at the diversity within their, you know, authoritative DNS record in terms of where these servers are located geographically, and then look at the provider diversity. I think really, if anything, the DDoS that happened on Dyn, whatever it's called, was more of an exercise in applied disaster recovery more so than it was in anything else.
Yeah, maybe. So once again, the porn guys lead the way. Is that what you're saying?
That's right.
The summary of that blog post is Pornhub is actually doing security better than some security thinking air quote companies, if you will, because, you know, they have a very robust bug bounty program. they have really good diversity in their DNS providers, and as well as the geographic spread of where these servers are located.
I mean ultimately we know how to do this. We just have to do it now. And we need reasons to do it, but we know how. We do know how.
Exactly.
So we can look for Pornhub to be in BSIM version 8 next year?
Sure, why not? We have it's fine with us.
Awesome. All right. Well, Gary, thank you for being on our respective podcasts. Is there some way that are you going to be speaking anywhere in the next 2 to 3 months that people might want to be able to look for you?
I am just now in the very beginning in 2 days of what I call No Fly Noel. I don't fly in December, so I will be in Virginia, mostly in my house in December. You can always find out what I'm doing by going to my website. It's just GaryMcGraw.com.
Okay.
And information about, stuff I've written in books and even the music. I'm more likely to do a music show in the next 2 months than to play a show. And I think I'm playing in Winchester, Virginia in January before I give another lecture. Now, there are some things that are in the future. But, I'm in this period waiting for the transaction with Synopsis to close, which should happen sometime very soon. And I'm going to be at much bigger liberty to talk about that combination going forward after that.
Okay, excellent. And you're available on Twitter and elsewhere?
I'm easy to find, yep. The first 800 hits on Google are me. My Twitter handle is @SigitalGem. That's one of them anyway.
Cool, excellent. Joe, thank you for helping set this up. Of course, Gary also does the Silver Bullet podcast. So any Breaking Down Security listeners want another excellent podcast, there's one right there. So, Joe, for our listeners, how would people find you and your podcast and on the internet?
My podcast and blog is advancedpersistentsecurity.net. I'm on Twitter @C_3PJoe. And the blog and podcast has its own Twitter @ADVPersistSec. Subscribe to my mailing list on the website. I put out links to all of my blogs and podcasts. I've been doing a lot of guest blogging lately around the world with like Tripwire and ITSP, several other entities. So, get on the mailing list, follow the blog and the podcast, and I'll definitely share it with everyone there.
Excellent. As always, Mr. Betcher, my co-host and Abbott to my Costello, how would people find you if they wanted to discuss security and leadership and SDLC stuff with you?
As always, you can hit me on Twitter. My handle is @BetcherPwned, BoetcherPwned.
Right on. So for listeners of Joe's show, you can find Breaking Down Security at our website, BreakingSecurity.com. That's BrakeingSecurity.com, security.com. We're our official Twitter is @BrakeSec, BrakeSec. And you can follow me, Brian Brake, at Brian Brake, BryanBrake. And, like Joe said, we're all over the place. We're on Stitcher. We're on the TuneIn Radio app. We have official forums over on cyberary.it, which is a great place for some security training and regular training if you need it. I do some posting on Peerlist as well. So, you can hit us up. Check out our show notes for all the other places. We're on iTunes. We have a Patreon for people who find value in our podcast. We believe in the value for value model. If you find value in Gary and our talk today, please feel free to drop us some money for upkeep and maintenance of the show. That was it for our show. Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Gary. And of course, Mr. Betcher, as always, for taking time out of your day. It was great for everybody to be on. I appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity, you guys.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for coming on. Right on. One last thing from my side, I'm also on Peerlist, so I've been posting a lot there, and both Brian and myself maintain Slack channels. We forgot to plug those as well.
That is true. Yes, our book club with Gary's book, our next segment is actually November 29th, so if you're listening to this now, it's been a week late for our show, but just join us on our Slack channel, breaksec.signup.team, and we'll get you into the book club. There's still several chapters left to discuss, unless Gary has ones he wants us to skip other than chapter two.
Skip two.
and my Slack channel is actually aps-opensource.signup.team.
Right on.
Thanks, guys.
Yep. Well, that was it for Breaking Down Security. I hope everyone has a great week.
Bye-bye.
Have a good one.
And we're clear. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. I will post the raw audio of this show to Google Drive. I will just post it as a 256K MP3 file. I'll send it out to everybody. So if you want to have it, I know Gary said he wasn't probably going to put it on his show. Yeah, that way you'll have it in case.
Certain format, and I'm actually not telling anybody, but I'm going to do all women for the next year.
Okay, so, right on. Yep.
I have a few good recommendations based on my own experience for women to have on your show.
Excellent. Please email me that. I collected a bunch on Twitter. I have like 200 women in the.
Yep, I follow a couple of hundred ladies over there on Twitter as well. We had some we had a CISO lady who Kim Green, who's out of San Francisco.
Oh, I know Kim. Yeah, Zephyr. Yeah.
She's good people. So
are we recording?
No.
I can. Let me stop the recording.